This is Seeds for Success, a show where we have a good yarn about ag life with producers who are having a go. On the show, you'll hear from farmers in New South Wales who are out there battling the elements, making tough calls and getting the job done. You'll get a laugh out of some of their stories and also pick up some know-how along the way. I'm your host, Neroli Brennan. This week on Seeds for Success, we sit down with Peter Grant, who along with his wife Samantha run a mixed farming enterprise on Nariman, a 530-hectare property on the Lachlan River, about 50 k's west of Forbes. As Peter explains, roughly half of their property is developed for irrigation, which is spread between summer and winter crops, as well as irrigated pasture for their cattle enterprise. In today's episode, Peter talks about the many crops he's enjoyed growing, but especially his favourite crop, sweet corn, and shares with us how he's maximised his water use efficiency, as well as the innovative ways they're approaching fall armyworm control in their corn crops. You'll also hear how Peter has introduced the use of drones in his business in an effort to overcome the current labour, skills and time shortage. Local Land Services mixed farming advisor Rowan Leach sat down for this chat with Peter during a short break from the sweet corn harvest.
G'day listeners. Today I'm with Peter Grant, who farms near Waru, about 50 k's west of Forbes. Peter, welcome to the Seeds for Success podcast.
Thank you for having me, Rowan.
Mate, can you start off by giving us a bit of a rundown at your operation here at Nariman?
We've got about 1,300 acres, majority's irrigation. Predominantly, it's popcorn, and now sweet corn has been the main irrigated crop. Wife Samantha, she runs commercial Angus breeders, and then just a bit of winter cereals just over the winter time.
I know Sam's probably got a different opinion on the importance to the cattle to the operation, but what's the split there? What's cropping cattle?
There's some in-depth discussions at times. Yeah, that's for sure. We pretty much just say most of the dryland area is Sam's, and then one pivot. We keep us for her, so as it's just a stable place where she's always knows she's going to have summer and winter feed.
So sorry, amount of hectares under irrigation?
80 hectares under pivots, and then 190 hectares laid out to row crop. Overbank siphons is what we have at the moment.
And having the two different systems there, what's your preference to operate with? The row crop and the flood irrigation or pivots?
Let's face it, the pivots are incredibly easy to work. It's push-button irrigation. But where it sort of does work on those hotter days, if you can see a 40-plus degree days coming in a couple of days before with a row crop, I can bring an irrigation forward and I'm putting on 0.6, 0.7 of a meg out of the hectare, and it gets really good humidity within the crop. But the pivots, I always feel you've probably got to be a week ahead of really where you want to be all the time.
I've definitely, in my experience, in a 40-degree summer, crops like corn or cotton, you can just see pivots just can't keep up sometimes when they're only putting on 15 mils of rainfall in a 24-hour period, say, and it's evaporating at 18 or 20 maybe.
Yeah, exactly. I think a rough guide I was given when we first had our a crop of popcorn under one of the pivots, I was paranoid about running out of water or getting behind. And I think someone told me once we put on 16 mil in a 24-hour cycle. And they were telling me every day over 40 degrees, you lose 10 mil to evaporation per day. And then for every 2 degrees after that, it's another mil. So, you know, you sort of, yeah, if you're 3 days behind, all of a sudden you start to become in a negative. Yeah, so that was a good rule of thumb I sort of go by. But I just in general try and keep the ground moist, just looking at my probes all the time and just trying to watch where my root zone is. And if it's starting to look like it needs it, yeah, we probably should have irrigated a couple of days ago.
So you mentioned probes there. You've got a few on the farm?
Yeah, we do. Yeah, we run our Incentec on the EnviroScan program. I think they're the key to irrigation efficiently. We watch them all the time, work out where your root zone is, where it's feeding from, and then we can sort of group up an irrigation. If we're sort of a couple of years ago where it was quite damp, we didn't get a real deep root system, and so we had to start grouping up irrigations a bit closer together to keep the top profile full all the time. And the new Goanna probes, I had a run of those in the sweet corn crop we've just done. They're fantastic. You know, they actually sort of calculate all your water usage, your efficiency, and then, you know, give you an estimate day of when it should be irrigation next. So yeah, I thought it was a great platform. I could have a bit more of a play around, but yeah, I thought the Goanna app was fantastic.
And so how do you select your sites for your moisture probes? How many have you got across the farm?
I got four sites. We just try and find sort of just a middle of the road. When the crop comes up, we put it in probably at about around about that V2 stage. And I just find a nice consistent row, looks a bit sort of even, and you try and sort of get it nicely in between two plants. So it sort of looks like it's kind of the average of the actual field.
And just sort of going on soil type and making a rough best guess, I guess.
It is, yeah, it is. It's a best guess. And then, yeah, it doesn't hurt to go out and have a bit of a dig around, which, yeah, it's every couple of days you're crop checking. Yeah, you just take a shovel and have a bit of a dig and just make sure everything is running how it should. And you can correlate that back to what the probe's telling you. And, yeah, you can make a pretty good decision on it.
So just yourself and Sam involved in the business, or have you got any other staff?
Probably just ourselves. As my young fella Will, as he's getting older, he's getting roped into tractor driver after school occasionally. Anyway, it's good to hang out with him after school. We sort of got a few little odd jobs to do, but we've got an old fella, Bruce. Yeah, who helps out. I think he badly wants to retire, but also I think he loves operating the drone and loves sitting in a tractor, just listening to ABC all day, uninterrupted. So, yeah, I think he's actually enjoying his trial retirement.
So how long have you been farming here at Nariman for?
2016 Nariman and 2018 Otiza, which is a block across the road where majority of the row crop is.
What brought you to the Central West? Where are you from originally?
I actually grew up in the suburbs of Melbourne. Then when I was about 18, 19, bought a place in Hillsville in the Yarra Valley. We did a bit of a short stint up in North Queensland before coming to here. We just had some friends in the area, really quite liked the area. Love the availability of irrigation water around here. And when we decided, finally buy our own farm, this one, Nariman, was available. It had a bore, had the river, a couple of pivots, and they were falling down at the time, but they're back up and working again. It just seemed to tick all the right boxes, and we had a bit of support around here from friends as well. So, yeah, it kind of just ticked all the boxes at the time.
Have you got any advice for people maybe looking for a new place?
I think anything you can actually try and get a little bit of consistency and stability income-wise. So I'm a big fan of if you're going to sort of, get a farm for the first time, even if it's a little place, try and find something with a little bit of irrigation, because at least you know what you're going to get every year, and at least you know you're going to get a return every year. It just depends on whether it's dry or wet, how big that return's going to be. But, yeah, I think it's a great stepping stone because, yeah, you've got a bit of security in the water.
Mate, I know we'll probably focus a lot more on the cropping and that side of your business today, but just a quick one, how do you manage to integrate the cattle into your irrigated cropping or into your irrigation mostly?
They do stay pretty separate, actually. As I said, the front pivot here, we've just now dedicated to just the cattle. It was the back one as well, but, we've sort of gotten to a stage now with this year where we've just got feed coming out our ears and not enough mouths to eat it. So now we're just backing off to just one pivot. Sam's got in permanent pastures on one side and plan on putting in permanent pastures on the other. And we found once established, we don't have any downtime of the summer to winter cropping. It's a bit of a discussion between myself and Sam, which I've lost that one, and rightfully so, I think, because, yeah, I was always for getting, big bulk of feed from a summer than a winter crop. But you've also got, two or three months of downtime in between, establishing, those winter or summer crops. But although you don't get that massive upfront bulk that you would out of a sown crop, the pasture is just consistently there 12 months of the year. So I think it's been a great choice.
And finding it maybe quicker to graze, for example, than if you were to run around and sow a forage crop?
Yeah, well, it gets its roots down. So especially in the lighter red country too, we can actually give it a big decent water and get the moisture down low, and the root system's down there. It's nearly 18 months old, that stand now, and so its roots are well and truly down and hangs on in the light red country a lot better. We're keeping a good ground cover there all the time, so it also stops that hot radiance of heat above the surface, when you try and first establish crop, especially a summer crop in that light red. You've got to really keep the water up to it so you don't get that burn on the early young leaves. So it helps out a lot that way in keeping that constant ground cover. And, yeah, it doesn't take a lot for it to pick back up again either.
You've talked a fair bit about your water. Have you got dry land cropping as well?
Yeah, there's about 200 hectares of dry land area. Usually we're trying now to keep a winter crop coming straight in the back of a summer crop because they can pick up, you don't dry it down all the way. So it only takes a minimal irrigation to bring your profile back to full again. And, we get a lot of bang for our buck in our crop up front, and then we can just trickle feed it over the winter time, just to keep popping up a decent yield out of it. So yeah, we found when we used to just lock a paddock up and just say, right, we're just doing summer crop with that one, it could take a hell of a lot of water. And especially, this recent fields, it was 60 hectares. We've got sweet corn now. We let it fallow out and it took 1.7 megs a hectare just to refill profile. Yeah, I'm surprised at just how much it can actually dry down by, giving it a long fallow.
So you found having a crop in there growing potentially and giving it sort of small incremental waters as needed through the season, you found that more sort of profitable as well as not taking that big lick of water up in one shot?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, consistent and, more profitable because, we're just not having to put that big whack up front. We can just keep topping up the profile as needed, depending on what that crop is, and then just the weather patterns throughout winter and summertime instead of, that big sort of bulk of water like we experienced in this 60 hectares, It was a hell of a lot to put up front and, a little bit concerning when we sort of put a lot of N up front in front of that crop before sowing. We put on 1.7 meg and I can't help but think I might have leached a fair bit of that out because I was water running urea pretty early on just because I see the colour wasn't quite right. So, that's where I think if we just continue double cropping all the time, it's a little top up.
So maybe we'll take a step back and just tell me what you've got in the ground at the moment. It's February 2024 at the moment for listeners when this is coming out. So, what's in the ground at the moment and what's coming up in autumn?
As we speak, there's harvesters and trucks going around stripping sweet corn at the moment. They started last Thursday. And
thank you for fitting me in, mate. That's much appreciated.
No worries at all, mate. Too easy. But, there's harvesters heading around there at the moment doing their thing. We've just finished baling millet and sorghum hay off one and a half of the pivots. We've got ground prep just about to start, 100 hectares where there was cotton grown and then wheat. And we were going to put a summer crop in there. It just started to get a little bit too late and I just wanted to get the ground back to just a better preparation and go back to beds, actually. Go back to a 2 metre bed type situation. I loved it when I originally had 1.5 metre beds, but it meant I had to put everything on 3 metre spacing and a few wheel bearings later and stuff on tractors. I decided, that those wheel spaces weren't a great idea on tractors. So we'll go back to a 2 metre bed and just leave them as is, which sort of I'm just going to have a go at just moving away from, any deep ripping or deep cultivation because I feel that sort of that heavy grey country, as soon as it gets a little bit dry, there's crab holes that open up that you can't find the bottom of. So I'm wondering if, my deep ripping has been pointless.
Deep ripping is certainly in the Central West from a lot of research I've seen. It can be very hit and miss. Sort of red soils, it's 50-50 whether you're going to help the soil or have no effect. But a lot of those, obviously the self-mulching or self and cracking clays, running a ripper through that to 30 or 40 centimetres deep when you've got a crack that's probably might be 2 metres deep, they sort a lot of their own problems if you look after the soil.
That's where we're up to at the moment. And then we've got half a pivot to permanent pastures. Cattle will graze off where the millet was on the other side of a pivot. The cattle will graze that off and then, we'll clean that up and get it prepared for permanent pasture on that side. And then just a bit of a discussion point, what we'll do with the back pivot. Obviously, a winter crop is going in there. There was forage sorghum in there, which we've baled. I'm not going to push it for a second crop there. We're just going to leave it alone, let the cattle graze that off and then go in with a winter crop, undecided as to what exactly. But I think majority of the irrigation country, I think we'll put to wheat, I'm thinking. Seems to just work well here and just seems to be just what I know. I feel comfortable with it and I think it's always consistent.
Are we into the patch of durum wheat here at all? Have you found with your consultant? What have they said or have you entertained that?
I've entertained a lot of things and 2016 and now, what's that, nearly 8 years on. I'm now just thinking I'm just going to stick to just basics that I know I can do well. Might not be this season be the highest profit margin, but I think I'm just going to stick with just something just that's basic. I know I can get a good yield out of and, just let the 5-10 year average just work for us a little bit there. So, I think after cotton was just we just got a little bit spooked with, having a go at something a little bit different where, a lot of inputs and a lot of cost doesn't always work out. It wasn't the greatest season to give that a go for the first time, but I've tried mung beans and we got mice at that stage. So we've had to play with a few different things. Some have been great. Some have not worked out so good. But, now just sort of wanting to find something that I just can say, okay, this is what we do year to year and just works well with our rotation. Something we can start to just manage easily and well for what we know.
And that'll most likely be sweet corn over summer and followed by maybe wheat or canola or something.
Yeah, wheat, canola and corn is pretty much what I think we're just going to work on. And then I think Sam had a really great run with some Moby barley cattle feed, so I think she might sort of think about that. But yeah, definitely starting to think in some of those dry land areas, yeah, maybe something start to year by year, maybe look to do a bit of lucerne and other sort of permanent pastures in those. So yeah, maybe eventually get everything, the dry land non-irrigatable into, something that's permanent. Trying to get the management a bit more basic and easy actually.
It sounds like you've had a lot of experience with different crops then. Maybe what's been your favourite crop to grow?
Corn, hands down, yeah. I love it, yeah. It's so rewarding. Like, I'm a big fan of just foliars and just titivating little bits and pieces. And, yeah, you always sort of get I've sort of found the things that work best for us and always get rewarded for it. You see the plant looks sort of happier. You know, you might sort of get a little touch up with a little bit of copper or boron or something like that and you can see the plant responds. So, yeah, I love corn. Yeah, and I've never done grit corn, but popcorn was the one prominently for years, and then we've just gone to sweet corn. So, and yeah, sweet corn's been fantastic. I think it's just going to fit in really well into our rotation. The management was pretty similar to when we grew popcorn. Yeah, it was very responsive to, you know, give it a little bit of love, and it sort of rewards you.
It's almost that horticulture sort of mindset in a broadacre crop.
Yeah, a little bit. So, yeah, exactly. Yeah, no, I enjoy doing that.
How about the other end of the scale? What's been the most challenging or pull your hair out crop?
I'll go down a wormhole if I say cotton. That was probably the most heartbreaking crop. But yeah, I'd probably say actually mung beans. Mung beans, you know, we had a fantastic crop there, and there was a few little things that I think I should have done differently to get a better result. But yeah, it was just like an amazing crop. And then, you know, the header went in there and next to nothing came off. And I've heard a lot of people, you know, call it mongrel beans, and I sort of could work out why.
I think all legumes are probably a little bit finicky and they can look great, and then actually the harvest index or what you actually take off in grain compared to what you can see there in the paddock can actually be quite low, and working out strategies to sort of bump up that harvest index is a big challenge for legumes.
Yeah, sure, yeah. There's been a few learning curves for sure, but yeah, I don't mind it. It gives you a bit more to think about and, you know, a few challenges and gets you thinking about what you do and don't want to do. And yeah, you sort of learn little bits along the way. Agronomist always used to say to me is that, you know, it's a learning curve, but whenever I heard the word learning curve, I just thought that was dollars that I wasn't getting back. But the knowledge will sort of repay you later on, I think.
So it sounds like you've tried a lot of different things, and at times you might have a very complex crop rotation. How do you manage that sort of complexity at times? Or is it less of sort of sticking to a few hard and fast rules and a bit more playing things by ear?
You have a plan at the start when the crop goes in, and, you know, Mother Nature always keeps those plans pretty liquid. So yeah, you do have to just play it by ear as to, you know, what you know, the bug pressure is. You know, we've had one corn crop 1 year where we had fall armyworm from 3 weeks in, and we just fought it the entire season. 7 sprays later, we ended up with a very clean crop, but it was a lot of effort to try and get it there. And then this year, not a single fall armyworm to be seen, you know, like plenty of Healy's. So yeah, different years, different challenges. You can put all these different chemistry and bits and pieces in the budget, but I think you got to be pretty prepared to be a bit adaptable, I think, within the season, because, you know, Mother Nature sort of throws different curveballs at you all the time. So I think if you're willing to adapt, I think you'll sort of always get there at the end.
You probably might not be able to answer this question, but were you growing corn sort of pre-fall armyworm before that became a problem?
Yeah, we were.
So how have you found that, the sort of introduction of that exotic pest, yeah, how has it affected growing corn in Australia?
Yeah, you hear some pretty devastating stories. I was paranoid about it. We'd grown a couple of crops, and then I started reading about this fall armyworm that could sort of come down and get us. So I made a few phone calls just to different people, and, you know, there was a mob ag biotech up at Toowoomba. They were fantastic to chat to. I just can't think of the agronomist's name up there, but, you know, he was brilliant just telling me about, you know, what you do in a management sense. And so we decided right from the very start that year, thinking that we potentially might see it, we decided to go all biological control. And that's the method we just run now, and we get a fantastic result out of it. So, yeah, we just purely run biological. Hasn't changed our margins too much using, you know, either SP chemistry or biological. Up front, it's a bit dearer, but I actually think I'm getting a cleaner and better result by, you know, letting the good beneficials do the work for us.
And so can you talk to me about that biological control? What is it? What's the product? How does it work?
Yeah, sure. So yeah, during fall armyworm period, that was Foligen was a product we used. If we got a little bit out of control, we were able to use Alticor at the time, but I think it's called Vantacor now. So it was really good in conjunction at a half rate with a half rate of Foligen. It worked really well to clean up anything sort of in star 4 and 5. We sort of did get a little bit behind potentially. But then if you then this year, I suppose, with it's only just been Healy's, we've just been using an equivalent, it's Gemstar, which is equivalent of Vivus. And if you sort of just keep an eye on it and you keep that virus within the crop, yeah, it's amazing just how well it works.
Correct me if I'm wrong, Vivus is similar to the BT toxin that GM Cotton uses. Is that right?
I think so, yeah. Don't know the in-depth of it all, but basically just a specific virus which, you know, just takes out your either Healy's or Fall Armyworm, whatever it's actually targeting. But I have found it's only really effective in star 1 to 3. Anything after that, yeah, they can get through it. So that's where you sort of, yeah, you're able to just chuck a little bit in, but yeah, you can only sort of put a couple of those sort of heavier chemistry in, just have a bit of a clean up.
It is funny when you sort of come across some pretty serious croppers like yourself that they're using biologicals as well, not just for the warm and fuzzy feeling that it makes, but because it's probably the most effective product at any one time.
I think that was a best takeout from growing cotton was it's fantastic just how evolved they are with, you know, doing bug counts or your beneficials and, you know, really holding off to the last minute before you actually start to use any type of chemistry, you know, just keep those beneficials in there doing the work for you. I think that was probably the best takeout I got from, growing cotton and just how advanced they are with, you know, doing all their counts. Yeah, no, it was very impressive.
On to the next topic. You've mentioned that you use moisture probes pretty heavily, but that you've also gotten into drones as part of your cropping enterprise. Can you tell me a bit about that?
I had a friend who was using them, thought it was a great idea, and we just sort of struggled with a couple of times, you know, when you're tearing your hair out, you're trying to chase some bugs and call a plane up and, you know, they're always fantastic. You know, they go out of their way to try and get the job done for you. But, yeah, if I've got that bug problem, then chances are probably everyone else has. So I could be, you know, fourth or fifth in the queue. So, you know, you're waiting 2 or 3 days and then weather conditions might not be right, which delays another day and all this time you're watching your crop being chewed. So it was a pretty cheap little investment for, you know, being able to sort of be on time with any sprays. You know, if I see a bit of bug pressure today, I'll be spraying, you know, the next available day. Rotobucks don't have to be pulled out to, you know, early days getting, you know, you're self-propelled through the crop. No more sort of spend half a day or a day pulling rotobucks out. So that's great.
So what's the drone that you've got at the moment?
DJI T30.
What's the capacity and capability of that?
30 litres, which is a basic amount. So a lot of the time we're just spraying it sort of 20, 25 litres per hectare, yeah. And then, you know, sometimes 15, pretty basic, all programmable. You can set all your parameters of your field, buffer areas, margins, however you want to do it, your swath widths, height above crop. And we just found it can penetrate, you know, where we found going overhead, you get a little bit of shadowing area, especially in the corn. You get a little bit of shadowing plant to plant when you're going up the field. Yeah, so we get a lot of penetration down through the crop and the canopy just from prop wash. You know, I'm seeing sort of on using that splatter paper, we're getting right down to the base of the crop where, you know, if you're sort of going over it, you know, in the early days, you know, using a self-propelled above the crop for you, it's too high. I wasn't getting that. And so I'm getting a lot of, especially, you know, if you're trying to spread around the virus, you just want it everywhere. Yeah, so I've just found it fantastic for that. And the other thing is, you know, my old fella, Brucey, our 6-year-old who can barely turn on his phone, he just loves it because he gets to just sit there and, you know, the thing lands at his feet. He just fills it up, changes battery, presses go and it goes off and does its thing. He can go back to reading his paper for 6, 7, 8 minutes. Yeah, so he loves it. And it takes away, you know, a very, very important job that I used to only do myself. It's something now I can just take out all human error and, you know, get someone else to do it and alleviates me of a job and I know it's being done right.
Don't worry. I think there's plenty of ways that humans can find error into something.
100%. Yeah, that's right. True, true.
But, yeah, so what's the sort of hectare capacity of one of those things?
It takes 13 hectares, work on around about 2 odd hours. Yeah, so you're not getting over as fast, but as I said, I'm able to do it when I need to do it, exactly the day, the next day, if need be. And the other thing too is I can be putting sprays out while I'm sitting there, you know, waiting to do an irrigation change, you know, and those days where I'm just sort of, you know, not trying to get too far away because, you know, I've got to throw siphons or whatnot. yeah, I can just be spraying on those days. So it just makes it easy so for the management for us to be able to control any spraying that we need to do.
Just adds a bit of flexibility into the system.
100% it does, yeah.
Great. So what made you investigate drones as an option?
The amount of times that we weren't able to get on field, you know, I was finding that when you could get across it with a self-propelled, as I said, you know, first you'd have to pull out rotor buck, so that's a bit of a time-consuming job as it is. You know, you might irrigate today if you're on an eight-day cycle, irrigation cycle. Irrigate today, it's high 30s, 40 degrees, you know, still 2 or 3 days before you get on the field. You know, you strike a little bit of bad weather then, and all of a sudden you can't, and then you know, you might be up to the next irrigation before you can actually get back on the field. So then it's a mad rush to call a plane and get to do the job that, you know, you should have done 3 or 4 days earlier. So it's every day where the weather conditions are right is an available spray day, regardless of what the ground condition is within the crop.
Any sort of requirements that you've had to do, like licensing or anything like that?
Yeah, so you've got REOC and REPL, which is basically just remote pilot's license to be able to operate them, yeah.
How long did that take?
They're a six-day course. There's 3 days online and then 3 days in person.
Maybe that might be a bit of a limitation. Is there other limitations to them?
I really don't think so. I know a lot of people are using them to on hilly country spraying blackberries, and they've got those seeding tanks for them now. You know, they're able to sort of seed sort of hilly country, you know, for pastures and just, you know, to mitigate erosion control and whatnot. So, and the other thing too is spraying channels too. There's we've rolled a side-by-side buggy in a channel trying to, you know, get around them before, and it's, you know, 10 times faster. You know, you just whiz along it, you know, 20-odd K an hour spraying a channel, and you can nearly do it in one pass. You know, it's, yeah, very basic. It's helped out a lot. It helped with a lot of time constraints and weather constraints.
And safety, by the sounds as well.
And safety, yeah, 100%, yeah.
So you're probably not going to throw away your SP, but used in conjunction, it can be a very handy tool.
Yeah, for sure. Look, I think SPs definitely have their place. I mean, you can, the amount of hectares you can cover with those things, you know, it's fantastic. But, you know, I think it's a bit of a watch this space. I mean, you know, with these T30s, the swarm technology means you can link three together. You know, at a 7-metre swath, that at least gives you 21 metres. Yeah, so that gives you 21 metres, and, you know, you're spraying it, you know, you can spray it sort of 25-odd K an hour, depending on how much chemical you're putting out. And then, you know, there's talk of the new ones coming out in June that, you know, they're up to 5. So, you know, you're sort of up to sort of 35-odd metre swath if you sort of got 5 of those. They're pretty cost-effective. They're very cheap in comparison to an SP. So, yeah, I think it's a bit of a watch this space. I think over the next, you know, 5-10 years, I think a lot of people might sort of start to be looking to use them. When they start to get into a self-docking, self-charging space, you know, get complete autonomy within the unit, I think that's where it might be, you know, really start to change the face of agriculture.
Any plans for you to buy another, maybe two, to get this swarm happening?
I haven't until I'm sitting there very bored waiting for the thing to come back, thinking of all the other things I'd like to be doing, you know, the times I'm doing it. So 2 or 3 would be very handy, yeah, definitely. It's in the back of my mind, especially when I'm sitting there bored, as I said.
Well, Pete, thanks for talking today, mate. And just before I let you go, for my final question, I always like to ask our guests, what do you think the big issue in Australian ag is at the moment?
I think getting young people involved, for sure. Yeah, I'd love to see like some type of an apprentice program getting to agriculture. I think that'd be fantastic, you know, something that actually have got a qualification. I mean, we can get plenty of bums in seats being tractor drivers, but something they can walk away with a qualification, I think, you know, would serve us really well for future employment for a lot of kids that weren't born on farms or haven't got someone who they know that they can sort of get into a role or be given a go. But if it sort of becomes like an apprenticeship, some potentially subsidised, yeah, I think we could have a, you know, a lot of great operators.
That's a great one. I don't think we've had that before. Yeah, having that sort of almost like a trade, you've got like minimum standards that they're used to, and they could probably walk into a workplace and command like a decent wage and say, well, this is what I'm capable of. This is what my salary is.
Yeah, no, I think it's definitely a topic. I think, you know, it'd be great to discuss later on. But yeah, I think someone who's done a qualification, and, you know, let's face it, every farm isn't going to do everything you're going to need to know, but you go to a TAFE and they sort of fill in the blanks that your employer might not necessarily do, you know, makes them pretty broad base in their knowledge to, yeah, walk into a job elsewhere.
Good one, mate. I've had a cracker today. Thanks for your time, Pete.
Thanks so much, Rowan. Appreciate it.
Thanks for listening. This podcast was brought to you by Central West Local Land Services. Local Land Services delivers advice and support to farmers, landholders, and the community across New South Wales. To learn more, you can find us online by searching for Central West Local Land Services. If you'd like more information about the topics we discussed today, as well as links to relevant articles, fact sheets, events, and other helpful resources, we've added those into the show notes for this episode. You can find them by tapping or swiping over the cover art in your podcast player now. Hey, and while you're there, please leave us a 5-star review. It really helps other farmers find the show. I'm your host, Neralee Brennan, and I'll chat to you next time.